Iran rejects Western media reports on a temporary agreement in talks with the remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Russia says it has killed up to 200 terrorists planning attacks ahead of the presidential election in Syria. Also, jurors begin deliberations in the trial of a white Minneapolis police officer charged with killing a black man as a fresh protest is underway in the U.S. city. Beginning with our top story, Iran's top nuclear negotiator has dismissed Western media reports that Tehran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are discussing a temporary agreement. Abbas Araghchi said there have been no talks on a temporary or step-by-step agreement in ongoing nuclear negotiations in Vienna. He said Iran is only discussing the removal of cruel anti-Iran sanctions. Araghchi said that following the principles outlined by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Tehran will not allow talks to become attritional, and that it will not be in a rush to see they are bearing fruits. The top negotiator said that Iran insists the talks be conducted diligently and in line with the country's interests and positions. Political commentator Richard Becker says the Western media that serve as another branch of their respective governments are presenting own calculation about the ongoing Vienna talks.
Big media, the corporate media, really serves as another branch of government in the United States, and I think in many of the European countries as well. And really, they are presenting what they're hoping for is that Iran would accept this, and really with the aim of the, clearly the aim of the Biden administration and Anthony Blinken and Campbell and the others is to wrest additional concessions from Iran. And it's quite clear that Iran is not interested in that and will not accept that as the basis for negotiations going forward, given the fact that the United States, the Trump administration, unilaterally broke off the agreement, really in violation of international law, since the Security Council had signed on to the treaty as well, to the JCPOA.
Russia's defense ministry says it has killed up to 200 terrorists in Syria during airstrikes on their hideouts northeast of the city of Palmyra. The ministry said two hideouts were destroyed in the airstrikes where terrorist groups were manufacturing explosives. It added those terrorists were planning attacks on government agencies in big cities ahead of the presidential election in Syria. The ministry also said that the terrorists were being trained in several camps in areas not controlled by the Syrian government, including Al-Tanf, which is held by the U.S. military. Syria will hold presidential election on May the 26th. We were earlier joined by our Damascus correspondent, Muhammad Ali, who gave us more details about Russian airstrikes against terrorists in the country.
Deputy Chief of Russia's Khmeimim Air Base in Syria, Alexander Karabov, said in a statement that they received information that terrorists were establishing the secret base northeast of Palmyra in Homs countryside in central Syria, and that they were manufacturing explosive devices over there and planning to attack various Syrian cities. Right away, Russian fighter jets launched airstrikes that destroyed that camp and areas that those terrorists were hiding, and also killed up to 200 terrorists, in addition to destroying 24 of their vehicles, those terrorists' vehicles that were loaded with heavy machine guns. There was also, as a result of this airstrike by Russia, about 500 kilograms of ammunition was also destroyed.
Bahraini rights activists have accused regime forces of torturing political prisoners protesting against their conditions in a jail. The activists say security forces used heavy-handed tactics against prisoners in the kingdom's notorious Jow prison on Saturday. Authorities have described the operation as a response to disobedience following repeated warnings. Bahrain's prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has also reportedly said that appalling prison conditions are fueling anger and anti-regime sentiments. Human rights organizations have criticized Bahrain over the situation of its prisons amid the coronavirus crisis. The Manama regime has put hundreds of activists as well as several senior political figures behind bars following the 2011 popular uprising against the Al-Khalifa dynasty. Well, jurors have begun the process to determine the fate of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin, who's charged with the murder of African-American George Floyd. The 12-member jury has been sequestered and is set to stay at a hotel for the night. The defendant faces up to 40 years in prison if convicted of the most serious charge. The deliberation started as the prosecution and defense wrapped up their closing arguments. Chauvin's lawyer said his client behaved as, quote, any reasonable police officer would. He argued that Chauvin was following the same practices he'd been trained for in his 19 years on the police force. The prosecution, however, said he used excessive force against Floyd.
But the force was too much. He was trapped. He was trapped with the unyielding pavement underneath him, as unyielding as the men who held him down, pushing him. A knee to the neck, a knee to the back, twisting his fingers, holding his legs for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. The defendant's weight on him.
The prosecutor said Floyd went on begging for his life until he could no longer speak. A verdict would end 3 weeks of trial in which 45 witnesses testified. People awaiting the verdict have staged a protest in Minneapolis to demand justice for Floyd. Footage showing the white officer kneeling on a handcuffed Floyd's neck while he kept on saying he couldn't breathe has sent shockwaves across the U.S. since May last year. A spate of incidents of police violence against the African-American community has prompted nationwide protest against police brutality and racial profiling. The coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc across Europe, mainly due to lackluster restrictions and slow vaccine rollouts. In France, the number of patients in intensive care units has once again risen. The health ministry also reported nearly 450 new COVID-19 deaths and some 6,700 additional cases. The figures have pushed the country's death toll to over more than 100,000 out of over 5.2 million cases. Italy reported over 300 more deaths and more than 8,800 new cases. So far, Italian officials have reported over 117,000 deaths and more than 3.8 million cases. Meanwhile, Turkish authorities have toughened up restrictions in an attempt to curb the latest surge of infections in the country.
Has imposed more tight restrictions to fight the spread of the coronavirus. Earlier, Turkish president said that the daily lockdown during the first 2 weeks of the holy month of Ramadan will start at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. The lockdown will last till 5 a.m. every day, as the weekend lockdown will continue with stricter measures and more police officers present in the streets to make sure citizens and residents are abiding by the rules. During the weekend, security forces in all 81 provinces were out to make sure people are not violating the lockdown. Tourists are the only ones allowed to be outside during the lockdowns. In Istanbul alone, some 20,000 policemen took part in this campaign. Turkish Interior Minister threatened to punish those who do not respect the rules.
We will be out with our full force. Foreigners with residency permits are also subjected to restrictions and lockdowns, and they have to obey the rules just like others. I have the authority to revoke the residency permits of those who try to exploit the situation, pretending to be tourists. We will not let this happen.
The death toll in Turkey surged last month when restrictions were relaxed. Some blame the people who didn't act responsibly. Others blame the government for taking decisions based on the economic needs of the country rather than what is better for people's health. Analysts believe the government must take stricter measures. However, it is the economic situation that is preventing it from doing so.
The government is doing its best against the pandemic, but unfortunately the cases are rising because the country cannot afford full closure of businesses. Therefore, semi-closure is the only solution, and people must be more responsible.
Turkish Health Ministry said 20 million vaccine jabs have been distributed across the country. This is as Turkey says it has potentially developed a vaccine that just entered the phase of human trials. Turkish Industry and Technology Minister Mustafa Varank has volunteered for the trials. Turkish government wants to welcome tourists again after the holy month of Ramadan. However, many believe it is still too soon for this step, as only 25% of citizens have been vaccinated. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost a key vote in the Knesset, dealing a blow to him as he tries to form a new cabinet. Netanyahu lost the control of the so-called Arrangements Committee in the Knesset. The committee is responsible for setting parliamentary agenda during the transitional period between an election and the formation of a new cabinet. Netanyahu has about two more weeks to form a ruling coalition. Defeat in the vote indicated Netanyahu still has some way to go to secure a majority in the 120-seat Knesset. Israel has held four elections since April 2019, with Netanyahu's right-wing party emerging ahead in each, but failing to form a stable coalition. A week-long security operation against thousands of protesters demanding the expulsion of French ambassador have been halted in Pakistan. The repeated incidents of blasphemy against the Muslim prophet in France is at the center of public resentment in Pakistan. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
After mass scenes of a failed security operation against thousands of protesters demanding the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan, the public resentment pitched high when the police launched operation against the protesters in the eastern city of Lahore. At the heart of public outrage is the revoking of a 6-month-old agreement by the government with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or the TLP, a political and religious group. The TLP championed the cause to expel French ambassador over repeated incident of blasphemy of Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. The TLP supporters allegedly attacked a police station in Lahore and kidnapped 11 policemen, including the senior official. Later on, the protesters released all the police officials. The police says an oil tanker with over 50,000 liters of fuel was also taken away by the protesters, which caused ripples within the corridors of power of its possible explosion. A strong public reaction once again forced the government to halt its security operation. There were countrywide wheel jam strike and closure of businesses after many opposition parties and other religious groups announced to support the TLP's demand to expel French ambassador.
How long we would put up with incidents like burning of Holy Quran? How long we would put up with blasphemy being committed against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him? But now we have decided not to tolerate it any longer.
Alarmed by public backlash, Prime Minister Imran Khan struggled hard in his live address to the nation to calm down public anger.
When Muslim countries stand up together and collectively boycott trade with France over blasphemy incidents, then it would have an impact. I would lead this campaign internationally now to prevent incidents of blasphemy.
Pakistan banned TLP last week, declaring it a terrorist organization in a country where violence against the police has become a norm by almost all major political parties to press their demands.
The government has resumed negotiation with the TLP, which is not ready to settle down on anything short of the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan. Now the TLP seems to be on a far more strong footing after a failed security operation against them. Therefore, analysts believe that the government is also running out of options but to withdraw its decision to ban it. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Washington has vowed to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan by September 11th this year, putting an end to its longest war. But reports suggest a large number of U.S.-led foreign personnel are set to stay in the country and maintain a shadowy presence there. This runs contrary to the U.S. claim that all of its personnel will be out of the country by September.
The United States announced last week its plan to withdraw all its troops from Afghanistan. In a White House speech, President Joe Biden said it was time to end Washington's longest war in history.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Biden said the withdrawal will begin from May 1st and conclude by September 11 this year. Shortly after his announcement, NATO said in a statement that it will coordinate its troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan with the United States.
In the light of the U.S. decision to withdraw, foreign and defense ministers of NATO discussed the way forward today and decided that we will start the withdrawal of NATO Resource Support Mission forces by May 1st.
The NATO chief said it is now up to the Afghans to reach sustainable peace. But the U.S. government has kept silent about whether it will also withdraw American private contractors conducting operations there.
So on the contractors, we don't know exactly. There's some preliminary plans. Clearly, the goal is to get all our personnel out. And I suspect that contractors will be part of that. Whether there'll still be a need for some contractor support, I just don't know. We don't have that level of detail right now. We're still working through that.
The New York Times has cited U.S. officials as saying that the U.S. is planning to continue its presence in Afghanistan by keeping the contractors and operatives in the country following the withdrawal of its troops.
Biden is trying to present himself as a new kind of president. And to do that, he has to make some pretend announcements that things are changing. This is one of them.
So why has the U.S. decided to pull out its forces if it's so keen on keeping its military presence there?
And that's your world news for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/EN.
Brandon Hall, the 19-year-old man who the police say fatally shot 8 people at a FedEx facility on Thursday night, 15th of April, legally purchased 2 semi-automatic rifles he used in that attack, just a few months after the police seized a shotgun from him. The chief of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department said on Saturday, 17th of April. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Andres Martinez, Mitch Smith, Allison Saldanha, Campbell Robertson, and Ali Watkins. The piece is titled, FedEx Gunman Bought 2 Rifles After Police Seized His Shotgun, Chief Says. Stay with us for more. Brandon Scott Hall, the 19-year-old man who the police say fatally shot 8 people at a FedEx facility on Thursday night, 15th of April, legally purchased 2 semi-automatic rifles he used in that attack just a few months after the police seized a shotgun from him, the chief of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department said on Saturday. In March of 2020, the police seized a shotgun from Brandon Hall after his mother raised concerns about his mental state, according to records. But Chief Randall Taylor said the fact that Brandon Hall was legally able to make the more recent gun purchases indicates that, despite his mother's warning and the police seizure of a gun, the authorities had not deemed him subject to Indiana's so-called red flag law, which bars people from possessing a firearm if they are found by a judge to present a dangerous risk. The revelation came as Indianapolis mourned the deaths of workers at a sprawling FedEx facility near the edge of city limits. The deaths and the gunshot wounds sustained by at least seven others during a shift change on a chilly night last Thursday jolted a nation where mass killings have become commonplace. At least four of the victims were members of the Sikh community, and the attack renewed the fears among American Sikhs, who have over the years been accustomed for wearing turbans and attacked in a house of worship. The shockwave went through the entire Sikh community, said Kanwar Prakash Singh, who has watched the Indianapolis area Sikh population grow from a handful of individuals to thousands strong since he arrived in the late 1960s. Why would a 19-year-old, he asked, do that to those innocent people? The family of Brandon Scott Hall, who was said to be a former worker at the facility, released a statement on Saturday, 17th of April, that apologized to the victims of this incident and said, "We tried to get him the help that he needed. He killed himself after the attack," the authorities said. They have not said whether hate or bias might have played a role in the attack. Under Indiana's red flag law, the authorities have 2 weeks after taking someone's weapon to argue before a judge that that person is unstable and should be barred from possessing a gun for a period of time. Police Chief Taylor said he was unsure whether a hearing like that ever took place in the case of Brandon Hall, though the police never returned the shotgun that they had seized last year. "I don't know how we held on to it," Police Chief Taylor said in an interview on Saturday night. "But it's good that we did." However, the police chief added, Brandon Hall went on to legally purchase a much more powerful weapon than a shotgun. On Saturday night, the police department announced that the two assault-style rifles that Brandon Hall used in last Thursday's attack were bought last July and September 2020. Those purchases, the police chief suggested, would have been possible only if a red flag determination had never been made. Red flag laws, which exist in more than a dozen states, moved to the center of the national conversation about gun regulation after a massacre at a Florida high school back in 2018. It remains uncertain whether a judge ruled against the red flag determination in Brandon Hall's case, or whether prosecutors took his case before a judge at all. The Marion County Prosecutor's Office did not respond to questions about whether they pursued a red flag ruling against Brandon Scott Hall. A search of online court records did not reveal any such case associated with his name. Under Indiana's law, a person is considered dangerous if he presents an imminent risk to himself or others, or if he fits certain other criteria, including a documented propensity for violent conduct. The seizure of weapons under these laws is often temporary. If the judge decides the person is so unstable that they should not be permitted to have guns, the seizure stands and the person is unable to possess a firearm for a period of months. Even if a judge decides that someone should not be allowed to possess firearms, that determination lasts for only a year. After that, prosecutors must either again prove that the person is unfit to possess firearms, or the ruling is lifted. As vigils took place Saturday across Indianapolis, flanks atop the Indiana State House were at half-mast. In the parking lot of a Baptist church on the city's west side, activists whose families had been impacted by gun violence gathered to express their support. And for the Sikh community, which has grown in numbers in central Indiana in recent decades, the size of the losses were overwhelming. Members of the Sikh community still recall the painful aftermath of the 11th of September 2001, when, in a wave of anti-Muslim sentiments, some Americans also targeted Sikhs with taunts of "Go home" or "Osama bin Laden." And Sikhs continue to mourn the killing of six people by a white supremacist at a Wisconsin temple in 2012. "We don't know whether this was targeted or a coincidence," said Dr. Sukhwinder Singh, a 29-year-old, a leader at his Gurdwara, a Sikh temple southeast of Indianapolis. "We're all so numb. This is something that will take weeks to process." At Sikh temples across Indianapolis, members gathered on Saturday to mourn, pray, and reflect on the circumstances of the shooting. Many of them described the victims from their community as hard workers, dedicated to their families and committed to their faith, which is known for its tradition of service, including supporting victims of natural disasters and organizing food drives during the coronavirus pandemic. Many Sikhs were among the 875 employees at FedEx's 300,000-square-foot sorting facility near Indianapolis International Airport, where parcels are whisked away into an automated system where they are digitally scanned, weighed and measured, shuttled around by conveyor belt and sorted out. A current job posting for package handlers at the facility promises up to $17 per hour. Jaswinder Singh, a new hire at FedEx facility who was excited to receive his first paycheck, was a daily presence at a temple in Greenwood, just outside of Indianapolis, where he would cut vegetables for temple visitors, mop the floor, and serve food. He sometimes stopped by the temple before heading to work. "He was a simple man," said Harjap Singh Dhillon, whose sister was married to one of Jaswinder Singh's sons. "He used to pray and meditate a lot, and he did community service." John Weisert, who at 74 years old was the oldest victim, had once been a mechanical engineer and liked to play country and western music on his guitar, said his son, Mike Weisert. He had been considering retirement. "He was hunched and arched over his back," Mike Weisert said. "The job was killing him by inches slowly. His career had been winding down, and some of us were worried." Matthew Alexander, a 32-year-old, another victim, had once attended Butler University. He loved to watch St. Louis Cardinals baseball and had worked at FedEx facility for several years, according to a friend, Ryan Sheets. He had recently bought a home in Avon, an Indianapolis suburb. "Matthew Alexander was someone who was the perfect friend," Mr. Sheets said. "Not a jealous bone in his body, he was a generous person." Samaria Blackwell, a 19-year-old teenager, was another victim. She had worked as a lifeguard and dreamed of becoming a police officer, according to her parents. On the court or the soccer field, she had a tough game face, but that quickly turned to a smile outside of competition, Ms. Blackwell's parents said in a statement provided by a family friend. Samaria loved people, especially those of advanced age. She always found time to invest in the older generation, whether it was by listening or by serving. Carly Smith, also a 19-year-old teenager, was another victim of this incident. She was a football player and a fan of hip-hop music, whose family said she graduated from high school last year. She was a kind of girl that if she saw someone having a bad day, she'd go out of her way to make them smile, said her brother, Brandon Smith. And Amarjit Sehon was another victim of this shooting incident. He had two teenage sons, was a regular at Sikh services, where she prepared lentils and served food to visitors to the temple.
Thank you. food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and here is a saying from the Prophet's eighth infallible heir, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, who on this day in the year 201 AH was declared heir apparent by the crafty Abbasid Caliph Ma'mun in order to deceive the Muslim masses. If the caliphate is your right, you have no right to give to others what God has determined for you. And if it is not your right, how can you pass on to others that which does not belong to you at all?
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
فیلم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
تقاضا میکنم از همه دوستان بزرگوار مؤمن و متدین این ماه مبارک رمضان رو یک بستر بسیار مناسب قرار بدن برای تقویت همون باورها و یکی از چیزهایی که
I sincerely ask all dear Muslim brothers and sisters to regard the holy month of Ramadan as an appropriate ground in order to strengthen their beliefs. One of the major factors which help us to strengthen our beliefs is to understand the importance of downtime or sahar. Allah the Almighty has put a treasure in the dawn, and this point is emphasized in the Quran too. Allah in the Quran mentions that He puts a precious treasure in the dawn from which we are unaware. In other words, Allah put a treasure in the dawn from which we have no knowledge. We don't know what the treasure is. Imam Hassan al-Askari stated, There are many roads to reach Allah. However, a fast vehicle is needed, and that vehicle is nothing but staying awake during the time of night and dawn. We as Muslims must recognize the importance of midnight prayer and early rising in the morning. This is why midnight prayer, keeping vigil during night and rising up in the middle of the night, was obligatory for Prophet Muhammad. Imam Ali alayhi salam too was always vigil during nights. He never missed a single dawn during his life, even when he was on his way to the mosque on the ninth night of the month of Ramadan, where he was going to be martyred. This is how important the dawn or sahar time is. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
And welcome back to The Light. Malaysian farmers tap classical music and massages to grow one of the world's most expensive fruits, Japanese muskmelons. The farmers believe the method is the best way to grow Japanese muskmelons in Malaysia's hot tropical weather. They regularly rub the melons with a soft cloth or glove. That's a practice, the farmers say, enhance the melon's flavor. To stimulate their growth, classical music is played in greenhouses. And now, all these efforts have paid off following constant trials. The farmers are finally selling their prized luxury fruits of labor on the market.
April is usually marked by multi-day festivities across much of Southeast Asia, including Myanmar, as they observe the Buddhist New Year. The traditional New Year in Myanmar this year began on Tuesday with five-day celebrations known as Tengon. The occasion is usually celebrated with prayers, ritual cleaning of Buddha images in temples, and public water splashing on the streets. They think water can wash their souls and all evil deeds. People also flock to temples with traditional pots containing flowers and receive blessing from monks. But typically, joyous period of celebration is looking very different this year amid coronavirus and political crises in Myanmar.
A dozen lucky penguins have been returned to the wild after rehabilitating from malnutrition and anemia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Argentina. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists. Some of them had lost their plumage due to malnutrition, but they recovered their feathers after receiving special nutrients. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after a Portuguese explorer, Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile. People in Britain are marking the easing of lockdowns implemented to curb the coronavirus pandemic. Words like freedom, hope, family, reunion, and relief have been projected on the walls of the UK's most iconic landmarks, as well as shops and department stores to show people's feelings. A British company commissioned a survey to find the words that best summed up people's feeling after months of lockdown began to be lifted on Monday. Those celebrating the event say reunion is the word that can best express their feelings.
The most powerful word in there for me is reunion. We've all been apart from each other, friends, loved ones, colleagues who are also loved ones, I suppose, in some cases. And really looking forward to getting back to my friends and family that I haven't seen for a long time, and imagine a lot of the British public are too.
The event comes as the UK has been the worst hit nation with a pandemic across Europe. The country saw a staggering number of infections and deaths for months. This prompted authorities to impose restrictions in an effort to bring the pandemic under control. Japanese Olympics organizers have unveiled the game's iconic rings on top of Mount Takara, a popular tourist spot in the west of the Japanese capital, Tokyo. The unveiling of the rings comes as athletes around the world are ramping up training some 100 days ahead of the international event. The sad side of the story, however, is that the spectators are barred this time to accompany the organizers to mark and celebrate it. This is because uncertainty still exists over how and even whether or not the games will take place. A surge of the coronavirus infections, including in Japan, is playing havoc with preparations ahead of the Olympics. Many hope mass vaccinations would help hold the event. Suppose you have run out of milk and you're not in the mood to shop for shopping. This is for you. Robots are lending a hand with grocery shopping in Singapore. A technology company has deployed two robots to a neighborhood for a trial period. Both named Camilo, the machines deliver items from nearby supermarkets and online shops to around 700 households. Designers say people tend to use robots in the pandemic era.
Especially during this pandemic period, everybody is looking at, you know, contactless, humanless, because in the robot itself, it has its own disinfection UVC light that we could do disinfection after every trip is being made by itself.
The robots are equipped with sensors and cameras, and they can carry up to 20 kilograms in their compartment. Users can track the robot on its way using the mobile application. The smart machines make 4 or 5 deliveries per day.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A section of highway winding through mountains and over the waters in central China provides people with picturesque views as it connects multiple tourist attractions in the region. Guzhuao Highway is located in Yichuan City in Hubei Province. The highway has a total length of more than 10 kilometers. Almost 4.5 kilometers of the highway stretches over valleys and streams. The highway also offers convenience for self-driving tourists. In order to avoid deforestation and protect the ecological environment, building bridges was adopted to replace a traditional approach of digging tunnels and constructing roads in mountains.
Now, a group of researchers have discovered a new mammal from the dinosaur era during their excavations in Chile. The creature, called the Oretherium zen, meaning beast of five teeth, inhabited southern Chile's Miocenes region during the Mesozoic era of the dinosaurs. This is a very important discovery as it fills a gap in information on the evolution of a mysterious group of mammals that became extinct and have no descendants today.
The interesting thing with this finding, and this is based on a fairly well-preserved portion of the jaw with five teeth, is that this animal probably was an omnivore. So it fed on plants, probably insects and other types of food, a varied diet. It coexisted in the same place with other forms of life, including mainly dinosaurs. On rocks with a data that indicates that it was between 72 million, 74 million years old. And this is located in the far south of Chile, in the Magallanes region, in the town of Valle del Rio de las Chinas.
The find may help scientists answer many questions they had for a long time about dinosaurs, mammals, and other groups. This discovery is more significant than other findings because a well-preserved jaw belonging to the dinosaur was found during the excavations.
To Egypt, where archaeologists have discovered an ancient city dating back to more than 3,400 years ago. The city, which is the largest ever found in Egypt, dates back to the Golden Age of the pharaohs. It's located in the city of Luxor, some 500 kilometers south of the capital, Cairo. The city had almost complete walls, as well as rooms filled with tools of daily life, along with rings, scarabs, colored pottery vessels, and mud bricks. Archaeologists say this is just the beginning of the discovery.
We believe that this golden lost city is the most important discovery after the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun. I call it golden because it was found in the golden age of Egypt, 1391 BC. I call it lost city because it was lost. No one really believed that the city could exist here. The dazzling Aton, three main districts, one area for storage. We found a big area for the storage of meat, making sandals, also sewing clothing, precious stones for making necklaces and bracelets, pottery. Tell us about the relation of Egypt with the New Kingdom. We think that this is the beginning of the discovery.
Abbas says only one portion of the city has been discovered. The team will excavate the area of the temples in September. One other amazing thing about the discovery is that archaeologists found a large fish covered in gold that may have been venerated by the people living in the city. Archaeologists claim this is the second most important discovery since the tomb of Pharaoh Tutankhamun nearly a century ago. As a famous saying goes, everyone deserves a second chance. That's true about humans and animals. Mary is a baby alpaca from Germany. Her hind limbs were severely damaged in a traumatic birth, forcing vets to amputate one back leg. However, that was not the end of the way for this cute woolly mammal. A charitable farmer found Mary and adopted her. Now she has her own special wheeled harness that she works with. Mary's owner hopes to give her an artificial limb once she regains enough strength to carry weight on her remaining hind leg. That way, she can live as a regular happy alpaca.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Above and beyond the reach of powerful politicians is the true business of the United States. its most profitable enterprise, and its ideologically ingrained mission, war. Practically nothing seems to get in the way of imperialism and war, and specifically the sale of U.S. war weapons abroad, says William Rivers Speed, editor-in-chief, in an article published under the heading Biden Breaks Campaign Promise and Approves Arms Sales to Saudi Arabia. Stay tuned for the details, please. Every so often, we get a glimpse at who is actually running this point. People like President Biden, former President Trump, Minority Leader McConnell, and House Speaker Pelosi give every appearance of being in charge of their respective spheres. And make no mistake, the power they wield is enormous. Consider those four. Pelosi could halt all legislation. McConnell can come close to doing the same. Trump is running the Republican Party, and Biden can peel the mantle off the earth with an order to his nuclear command center. Above and beyond the reach of powerful politicians in the U.S. is the true business of this country, its most profitable enterprise, and its ideologically ingrained mission, war. Practically nothing seems to get in the way of imperialism and war, and specifically the sale of U.S. war weapons abroad. War is not often allowed into the overtone window of permissible discussion, and when it is, we perceive it through a riot of patriotic noise. War has the best advertisers the U.S. has to offer. Their marketing puts all else to shame. Think about it. A politician proposes a social program designed to help starving children, and the first question always is, how much will it cost? But when expensive cruise missiles are launched by expensive sailors from an incredibly expensive warship to assassinate a foreign leader or obliterate some buildings, few people ask how much that cost. Hundreds of millions, usually, each time. It takes a fantastic ad campaign to hold down that level of popular buy-in, especially when it cuts deeply against people's own well-being. While the actual business of shooting wars is grossly profitable, they tend to draw significant media attention, at least for a while. Wars also historically had a tendency to be short-term. Before Iraq and Afghanistan, Vietnam was the only active war that kept paying out on a daily basis for 20 years. Every bullet fired, every bomb dropped, every missile launched, every helicopter shot down, every body backfilled translates into revenue for someone. For the war profiteers, those three actions made for 60 years of profit combined. That being said, the long, quiet, and reliable money is and has been for decades in this nation's worldwide sale of weapons, called Foreign Military Sales, or FMS. It is a business with enormous reach and clout in Washington.